Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they applied their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome to our very final episode for season one of the Potential Psychology Podcast. I've had a ball bringing this podcast season to you, and rest assured we will be back with season two. We'll just be taking a short break and we'll return in mid-June bigger and better. Today, however, I'm very excited to bring you our final guest for the season, clinical and coaching psychologist and fellow podcaster, Cassandra Dunn. Cass is based on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, where she runs a clinical and coaching psychology practice and teaches mindfulness meditation and other psychology-based programs. She's the resident psychologist for TIFXO.com, an online health and fitness program founded by Tiffany Hall. She writes articles and meditation scripts for a range of publications and health and fitness programs. She's co-host of the very popular podcast Crappy to Happy, and she's currently writing a book. Welcome, Cass.
Thank you very much for having me. What an intro.
I'm excited to have you because I've got a heap of questions that I want to ask you, and we've got lots of things I think we can talk about today. But I'm also just very glad that you could even squeeze in the time to speak to us, because that's quite a schedule of activities you've got going on there.
Well, to be honest, I have cleared my schedule a lot at the moment because of the book writing.
Uh-huh.
It isn't just one book I'm writing at the moment. I'm writing two.
Wow, there you go, busy lady.
slowly but surely. And I've got a pretty tight deadline. So I've actually cleared off a good deal of my face-to-face client work, and I'm sticking with the stuff that I can do from home and online, you know, this kind of thing, writing, Facebook Lives, the online work that I do.
Okay.
Until the books are out of the way.
Excellent. Okay, and I'm going to come back and ask you lots of questions about the book shortly. But firstly, I'm very interested because you have quite a fascinating story about how you got to where you are today as a psychologist, because it's not where you quite started. So I'd love it if you could share that story with us and tell us how you came to be a clinical and coaching psychologist.
It has been a long and winding road, and I should say it continues to twist and turn. So I did start off with an undergraduate degree in psychology straight out of school. I thought I wanted to maybe be a journalist, and I took an option in psychology. I found about very quickly I preferred the psych to the journalism, so I did my undergrad. It wasn't all that successful. I was, you know, very young and not really that interested in study. I would have preferred to be out doing other things. And so I really couldn't get out of there fast enough to go and start working. And I did what a lot of people did back in the day with a 3-year undergraduate degree in psychology. And I went to work for the Department of what was then Family Services. So I did child protection and juvenile justice work for a few years. Which is pretty hard work. You know, we're a group of young, very young, new graduates, basically. So I decided I didn't really like that after a while. And I also was working in not a remote area. I was working in North Queensland, and I'm based in Southeast Queensland, so I wanted to come closer to home. So I started applying for jobs in the government because I was working in the public service at the time. And I ended up in a job working with long-term unemployed youth. I had done as part of my my part-time work that I did while I was studying was often to do with youth and homelessness. I had an interest in that. So I sort of came back to working with young people and then moved into working with international students completely by accident. You know, the governments change and jobs come and go, and you sort of go where you can get work when you're in the public service. And I ended up in a management position. I got the job because of my counselling background, interestingly, but it really wasn't a counselling role. I was advising international students about their study choices and their study options. And then I moved into actually recruiting students, which is a sales job, going overseas, meeting sales agents. But all the while, I felt like the psychology thing was unfinished business. And it seemed to be getting further and further out of reach to go back and really complete that and do my postgraduate work. I'd bought a house when I was only 24. And so I got myself committed financially, and I couldn't just take time off and go back to being a student. But I remember distinctly at one point my manager saying to me, if you could have a choice of doing anything you wanted, Cass, like what would it be? And I said, I would go back and I would finish it. But, you know, I started a Bachelor of Business, hated that, started an MBA, hated that. Like, you know, you kind of know what you're meant to do. You sort of know in your heart where your interest is. So I continued, and the opportunity came when I actually met my husband and we got married, and he took a job in Sydney. And so I quit my job to follow him to Sydney. And we took a little bit, it was a turning point for me, because I thought, well, okay, I've got a choice here. I can just go back to all of the universities and all of the education institutes in Sydney and get a job doing what I've been doing for the past 5-6 years, you know, recruiting students. That's what I was good at. Or I could do something different. And I decided to become a life coach, because at the time it was the next best thing to being a psychologist.
I'm guessing this is around the early 2000s, was
yes,
it?
Yes. And a friend of mine in Queensland had, you know, was quitting her job and becoming a life coach. And everybody was saying, she's becoming a what? Because it was so new. And I thought, oh, that sounds like something that I could do. So I studied a course, I started getting clients, and I also enrolled in a master's in coaching psychology. And I completed that, and I was very successful as a life coach. But there was still in the back of my mind this nagging issue of not being a real psychologist, you know, not getting that final tick and getting my registration. And so, you know, and again, there were financial, I had to be earning an income and all the rest of it. There's all those challenges that people face when they want to make a major life change. But when I had my daughter, again, I had wound back my coaching business. I was self-employed. There was no maternity leave or, you know, parental pay or anything. So I wasn't making money anyway.
Yep. I know that feeling.
I said to my husband, I think this is the time. I think I have to do this. And it was a real long shot, because it had been 10 years since I'd finished my undergraduate. And there's rules in psychology about beyond 10 years, you have to start from scratch again. And I think what saved me was that master's that I had done in coaching psychology, because it had a heavy psychology component. It was a postgraduate level course. And so they took me into a fourth year, and I smashed it. And I thought that would be it. I thought that then I'd go and do like a supervision program or an internship and I'd get back to working. And as fate had it, we moved into state again, and there were those opportunities. And I thought, well, I've come this far. I've got no choice now but to finish it. So I actually had to go back and do in 2 more years and didn't finish my clinical master's. So I came to be a clinical and coaching psychologist.
There's lots of really interesting things in there for me, because I think that experience, I mean, I was very similar. I actually did an undergraduate commerce degree with a psychology major and couldn't do my fourth year in psychology because I wasn't from the right faculty. I had to be from the arts or science faculty. I'd come from the commerce faculty. And so couldn't do my fourth year. Then sort of set forth and thought, well, even doing psychology as a degree, it's still so incredibly broad. You know, just doing a straight undergrad and then your fourth year, which I went off and did at another university as an applied postgrad dip, something or other.
Yeah, I did that.
So, yeah. And it's still so broad. So it really didn't help me. So very similarly, I just kind of set forth into the corporate world. I did some work for the Telstra Research Laboratory, which doesn't exist anymore, where they were researching. It was the very beginning of the internet. That's how old I am. Actually, not quite the very beginning of the internet, but it was when the first organizations were starting to put websites online. So the mid-1990s, and I was at the research laboratories doing a placement, and they were looking at the usability, so that human-computer interaction piece, which I quite enjoyed, and the client organisation really liked me, so she organised for me to get this graduate job, and I had no idea what I was doing. And it was just that kind of path, and eventually I was very similar. I actually got back. I had actually done my supervision to get registered as a psych, but I went and did the coaching psychology masters at Sydney University as well. Yeah. And that kind of set forth. So this idea of, I suppose, not knowing where you're going, because I have lots of conversation, particularly with younger people now who are like, right, I need to know, you know, I need to have the plan, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And I'm like, I think certainly from my experience, from your experience, from talking to a lot of people, we don't know where careers will take us.
We and don't. I think
it's more about just being open to what the possibility holds.
I completely agree. And I understand that anxiety, and sometimes also there's a real sense of urgency, like I have to get this sorted. I think especially for young people, and I remember I felt a little bit that way myself, like everybody's getting on with it and I need to know where I'm going. I need to know what I'm doing. You know, yep. I have to have a plan. And oftentimes it does. It unfolds in its own way, in its own time, and you can only really join the dots in hindsight. Everything that I did led me to where I am, but I would never have known at the time that this is where I would end up. And particularly now, you know, I'm working online and an online health and fitness program, and I'm writing a book and I'm hosting a podcast. That was never in the plan.
No, well, those things didn't exist, did they?
Exactly. And I know, like, I have clients too. I have young people too who have that same, like, I feel stuck. I feel like I'm not doing the right thing, but how do I know what the right thing is and how do I make that happen? And, you know, I think it's that, like you said, Elizabeth Gilbert has that quote, you know, follow the curiosity. Just follow where your interests are, what makes you curious. Follow the breadcrumbs.
Yes, I love that. And I love the notion of curiosity. And I think you said that somewhere deep down, you can't, you know, that psychology, that commitment to getting that final, well, it's more than just a piece of paper, that final qualification. was always there underneath.
And
it was allowed, I suppose that's part of the curiosity, wasn't it? That it kept kind of pulling you back and saying, there's something.
It was unfinished business.
Yeah,
it was unfinished business. And it was, I just felt like I kind of let myself down by taking this other easy option. I just fell into jobs and I was good at what I did. You know, whatever job I did, I was promoted and, you know, I was successful. So it's very easy to fall into that and to be comfortable with that. And I thought, yeah, but, you know, it's not really deep down. It's really not where I want to be. So sometimes you've got to make the hard, uncomfortable decision.
Absolutely. And that's what I was going to say, because that kind of theme of a bit of courage in there, I think, came through when you were describing that path, that there had to be a bit of courage to say, right, this is good. I'm successful. I'm getting money, you know, especially when the finances come into play. And I know that's a big issue for a lot of people when it comes to making career decisions, but I need to have the courage to step outside of that comfort zone in order to fulfill this other need that I have.
Yeah. And fortunately, my husband has been very supportive all the way along, because we couldn't have done anything we've done without him being prepared to have a steady job and to be prepared to pay the bills and support me through all of those things that I've wanted to do. But truth be told, you know, we went backwards financially for a long time while I pursued this. And I think some people perhaps aren't necessarily prepared to do that. Yep. And that becomes a values choice.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. So having got to this place of being a clinical and coaching psychologist, who are the people that you work with now? I mean, you've got two, or perhaps even taking a step back, can you describe for our listeners, you know, the difference between being a clinical psychologist versus being a coaching psychologist?
Yes. So, you know, I think officially the way it's described is that clinical psychology is focused on the treatment of mental health disorders. So we're talking about mood disorders, depression, anxiety, people who, you know, we talk about taking people from minus 10, you know, back to zero. They might not be all the way at minus 10, they might be minus 5 or minus 6, but getting people from a state of having a problem that needs to be resolved to get them back to normal functioning. Whereas with coaching, we're talking about people who are functioning normally. You know, there is the absence of mental health issues. Having said that, you know, statistically, we should say the absence of a current mental health issue.
Yeah.
Because statistically, most people experience something along the spectrum at some point in their life. So, but people who are currently well and healthy and functioning, but who really want to take their life up to the next level. It's a goal that they want to achieve. It's that, you know, feeling stuck and wanting to get some clarity and direction and purpose. There's a lot of energy in it. There's a lot of action. It's very action focused. And, you know, it's also a little bit about getting into uncovering what some of those blocks might be, the self-doubt or, you know, the limiting beliefs that people have, but it's not getting into the treatment of disordered, you know, psychological disorders.
Yep.
So that's where the line is, I guess. That's where the differentiation is. Since coming out of my clinical master's, I've been mostly doing clinical work. I continue doing my my coaching for a long way through my master's, my clinical study. I had clients who I continued to see and consult with over Skype and over Zoom, and I still do some coaching now. I'm getting probably back more into coaching now. But as a clinical psych, young women I work a lot with. I had a very heavy focus on young mums. I did a lot of work in postnatal depression. I've always had the sense and had the belief, I guess, that I tend to attract, I think we all tend to attract people who are like us in some way. I think, you know, like attracts like, and people resonate with you. They resonate with your vibe, your message, who you are as a person. And so I had a young child. I had a lot of young mums as clients, people who struggled with postnatal distress, you know, anxiety, depression, all of that sort of stuff, which I did as well. And I did my master's research in mindfulness because I got heavily involved in mindfulness as well during my clinical studies, using mindfulness in pregnancy to reduce the risk of postnatal depression. So then it sort of naturally evolved into working a lot with new mums and pregnant women and a very heavily mindfulness-based approach to the work that I did. Then a lot of young women, again, I think also that as a clinical psych, you often rely on GP referrals. And so when a GP likes you and likes the work that you do and you're getting results for their patients, they will tend to continue referring. And GPs often attract the same type of patient. So I had a GP who was a young woman herself, and she attracted a lot of young women as patients, and, you know, word of mouth spread, and then she referred everybody to me. So I ended up with a lot of young women, university age or just leaving university. Again, very issues around anxiety, yes, all the typical stuff that we deal with, anxiety, depression, relationship issues, you know, body image issues, a lot of that stuff that affecting young women. So they were predominantly the two main groups that I would have worked with as a clinical psych.
Okay. And that, I was just thinking about those young women, because I suspect it might tie back into the conversation we were just having about that. Who am I? Where am I going? What am I doing? That kind of high sense of I need to have made decisions about what the rest of my life looks like, and getting comfortable with this idea. And I don't know where that comes from. It's an interesting thing, whether this is a societal thing that tells us that we need to have everything together and have a clear focus on where our career comes from, because it doesn't seem to be anybody's reality.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And sometimes it is giving people a bit of a reality check is the issue. But if I were to say there was a common theme with those young women and also the young mums, they were very switched on, very high achieving, intelligent, perfectionist. I think perfectionist is our greatest undoing. People, you know, we place so much pressure on ourselves, and women, high achieving, driven women, place so much pressure on themselves. And then it causes all sorts of issues, all sorts of anxiety. It just gets in the way of living life fully. So, you know, good on them for getting to a point at that stage of life of being able to say enough is enough. I need to address this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting you say that. My very first podcast interview was actually with Dr. Jo Mitchell from the Mind Room in Melbourne, and they run a lot of public workshops for people around, you know, with a positive psychology flavour. But she was talking about exactly the same thing. These women in particular who feel that they set themselves very high expectations. They feel that they need to be everything to everybody, and they allow that, and perhaps some of the anxiety around, you know, living up to their own high standards get in the way from living exactly as you say. So common themes in other places.
Yeah, just common universally, I think. Just, which is, you know, and this is these common themes that come up, and that I know I'm getting ahead, but, you know, this is why I'm so passionate about getting that message out, writing the book and, you know, doing the podcast and addressing some of these things in a way that's, you know, broadly accessible to people. Because I don't think, you know, one of the things I firmly believe is you shouldn't have to spend $200 an hour and sit in a room with somebody to learn some of these things. Information should be available. Strategies and tools. Yeah, strategies and tools.
That's why you're here talking to me, so that we can spread this message. So that leads me into my next question. So you are a podcaster yourself. Oh. You co-host the Crappy to Happy podcast with Tiffany Hall. How did that come about?
Well, that was another long, windy road. I won't give you all of the nitty-gritty details, but we relocated again. Another pretty big ballsy decision a few years ago was to sell up our place in Brisbane and to move to the country, because we both, my husband and I, had always wanted to live on some acreage. And while our daughter's young, we thought, what better time to do that? Like, the time is, there's never a good time. Let's just do it. So we moved to acreage on the Sunshine Coast, and we love it here. And I wanted to scale back from the face-to-face work and focus on doing more online kind of work, whether it be online courses or writing blogs or whatever it might be. I didn't know what it might be. And out of the blue, somebody contacted me, turned out to be a friend of a friend. The friend actually also was a University of Sydney coaching master's graduate who I met during that. We're everywhere. She's a very good friend, has remained a good friend. And so she referred me to her friend, who was looking for somebody to write articles for online wellbeing platforms. So she had a look at my blog. She got in touch. She said, would you be interested in doing this? And I said, for sure. So I started writing for her, and then they went on to work with, their business is now working with fitness trainers to develop online fitness programs. And they wanted to incorporate a psychology element. So I started working with Tiffany Hall on her program, tiffxo.com. I kind of provide the, I say, motivation, mood, mindset, that kind of aspect of wellness and well-being and achieving goals and health goals and fitness goals. And so Tiff and I just hit it off. And we had a really similar philosophy, especially when it comes to women and weight, you know, about getting rid of the scales, focusing on self-compassion, focusing on being the best version of you and not what society tells you you need to look like. And, you know, Tiff's really strong on that message as well. And we had a joke one day that people were listening to us talk one day and said, you two should have a podcast. And we said, that'd be fantastic. We should do that. And we just forgot about it. And now, lo and behold, a few months later, she contacted me and said, hey, Cass, would you really like to do a podcast? And so she'd had this opportunity. They're looking for submissions for this new podcast network launching in Australia. And we said, for sure. So again, we pitched the idea. They loved it. And the Crappy to Happy podcast was born. So for us, it was about probably the opportunity to expand on those conversations that we were having every week inside that private community, that online group. People were just lapping up that information. But we used to do these 5 minutes. We still do these 5 minute, 10 minute kind of grabs about just covering a little topic. And we thought, imagine if we could go deeper into these topics and just put it out there for everybody to be able to access. So that's what we've done. So we've done season one and season two, and it has been a massive, massive success. We're fortunate to have the backing of a very large podcast platform network in Australia and also in the US. And we just hit 1 million downloads. So
congratulations.
I know. It's but we get a lot of support also. I guess we had an existing audience inside the TiffXO online community, but, you know, it's certainly become broader than that.
What are the topics that you cover? I mean, well, I know because I listen, but listen to our audience.
So in our first season, we recorded 10 episodes. I tell you what, that's a challenge, 10 episodes back to back. We record them over the space of a couple of days. So it's brain frying. But we really wanted to hit in the first season the topics that were coming up over and over again in our community. And Tiff covers the fitness, the physical fitness side, and I obviously cover the psychological, emotional side. So we've covered issues like self-criticism and perfectionism, overcoming self-sabotage. Self-sabotage is a massive topic that comes up for people. Emotional eating. She dealt with the things like the how to train more effectively, the effects of sugar on your body. We covered sleep, all those sorts of topics. They're just the ones that came up all the time. And then in season two, the idea was to go a little bit deeper. And we covered off things like, oh my gosh, I can't remember what we covered in season two. Life after a baby, because Tiff had a baby.
Okay.
Yep. In between season one and season two. So she was dealing with all that post-baby stuff. And obviously I've got a background, heavy background in postnatal kind of stuff, as well as having my own baby. Aging gracefully, finding your passion if you don't know what it is. Things like that. Just this kind of stuff that people confront and deal with in everyday kind of life.
Yep.
And just giving our take on, and you know, and what some of the research is about why that is, and helping to normalize those things. And our aim really was giving people really tips and strategies and practical tools that they can actually go away and apply, not just to talk the theory, to say, okay, well, go and do this or try this or, you know, see how that works. And I think that's what people have really appreciated.
Yeah. And that's really very much the essence of coaching, I suppose, in a way, isn't it? That, you know, it's just coaching via a different forum. Here's a bit of information, something to think about. The only thing you can't do so easily is actually ask the questions that you would ask of someone if you were coaching them face to face or even online. But at least exactly. That bit of what we as psychologists would call psychoeducation, and then here's some practical stuff, go and have a go and see how it works for you.
That's exactly right. And I guess we sort of know what the questions are because we're sort of responding to the questions we've already been asked.
You are. Yep.
Yeah.
And tell us a bit then about these books that you're writing.
So then the next stage, I mean, I guess I had in my mind that I wanted to write a book, the Crappy to Happy book. And I kept telling people, you know, I kept putting out to the universe, I'm writing a book. And really there was not much book writing.
Often the way it goes, isn't it? I'm doing this. Oops, now I've said I've done it. Better go do it.
There was a lot of thinking about writing books. There was a lot of like ideas about writing books. And I could never get myself to sit down and write it. But when the podcast came about, I thought, well, this is perfect because we're getting those ideas out there. And then if I can just summarize all of that into a book, then that's great. Then people can actually have something that they can take away. So I contacted a publisher and said that this had been my idea and they were interested. And they said they would be interested in a whole series of books, which is lovely. And could we get two of them going straight away? And I guess the idea is building on that crappy to happy theme, but looking at how there's the general stuff that we've talked about, but then looking at crappy to happy in different areas of life. So, for example, how to be happier at work, how to be happier in your relationships, how to be happier as a parent. There's all these different sort of areas, life domains that you can drill into and uncover, well, what are the challenges and how might you increase your sense of well-being and purpose and happiness in all of those different domains beyond just the broad brush kind of general life stuff. So they're not designed to be big, you know, all-encompassing heavy self-help books. They're more small, you know, little books, handbag-sized books that you can just, you know, pick up and read. We know people are busy.
Yep.
So
that's easy and accessible.
Easy and accessible, exactly. But still full of good information. I can't do fluffy. That's my challenge. I can't just do fluffy. It's got to be evidence-based, exactly.
All that stuff that gets drilled into us as psychologists.
Evidence-based. I know. Yeah. You can't just make stuff up. I wish I could. It would be easier.
It would, wouldn't it?
But it's got to be real and factual. So that's my challenge, and to keep it succinct, but to make it real.
Now, one of the things that struck me, Cass, and through all of our conversation thus far, but particularly when you said you just contacted a publisher and asked the question, you're clearly somebody who just grabs life with both hands and says, I'm just going to have a go and do this, even a bit like the book writing. You know, I don't really know what I'm doing or how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it. Where do you think that comes from for you?
I have no idea. Because we haven't even talked about the fact that I launched an online retail business at some point. Just while I was doing my clinical master's, I decided to set up an online vegan store and did that for 2 or 3 years. I sold it. It was quite a successful little business, but I thought, what am I doing? Never one to let an opportunity go by.
Clearly.
I think I read somewhere about an article about entrepreneurs and it said something about they focus less on the risk. I can't remember exactly what it was, but they were looking at, you know, you read all of these things about what makes people successful or what makes entrepreneurs different from other people. And is it, you know, it's not that they're smarter or it's not that they're this or that, but they have the same perception of risk, but they, I don't know, I think they're not as frightened of the risk. If I'd known you were going to ask me that, I would have really looked up what that quote was because it resonated with me. It resonated with me. I thought, that's me. I've made some really, you know, I bought a house when I was 24 and I had a 3-month contract job. Most people would say that is insane. But I just like, what the hell? I'll just get another job if I lose this job. I was never going to not be able to pay for the house. I've never had a concern that I was something really tragic would happen.
Yeah.
Which maybe, and it hasn't so far.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, as I said, I mean, it came across and I didn't even know I was going to ask that question, hence not giving you any prep, but perhaps you can look it up and we'll pop the quote in the show notes following up from this episode.
Going with not as being as risk averse, you know, and I think that sums me up because I've made decisions that aren't really smart, but what the hell?
And I think
life is short.
Yeah, that I wonder. I mean, it's something I think about because I suspect I'm probably similar in lots of ways. You know, I wrote a book 10 years ago with a co-author and had it published. You know, it was published in the UK and the US, got translated into Dutch and all of these sorts of things that happened. And it was very much a similar kind of scenario of we got together, we were just like-minded people, didn't really know each other that well, had a conversation over coffee about how it actually comes back to what we're talking about early on about feeling like you have to have your life together by the age of 30. So the book was called Turning 30, How to Get the Life You Really Want. And it stemmed from a conversation over coffee where we thought, oh, that's a great topic. You know, that'd be a really good book. And we thought, well, we've got a bit of time. How about you go see what you can find out and I'll go see what I can find out. And the next thing we knew, we had an agent in London and we had a couple of publishers, you know, as possibilities. And then of course the terror, you know, set in because we thought, right, we've committed to this and we don't know what we're doing. And then you just do it. And I think certainly from my experience, and I'd be interested to know if this is yours as well. Sometimes we take these chances and we try something, and because it turns out okay, it fuels partly the desire, but partly that bit of self-belief that said, you know what, I did that and it wasn't the end of the world. So perhaps I can do it too.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And we're all, it's not that there's not self-doubt. And it's not that I think I'm the best at everything that I do. Like when we recorded these podcasts, I'll come home and have a sleepless night thinking, why did I say that? And why did, you know, that we're all our own harshest critics. But then when you get the feedback that it's fantastic and people love it and it's, you know, this has changed my life, you kind of go, oh, okay, well, maybe I should just lay off myself a bit. You know, maybe I should just accept that again, it's that perfectionism, but it doesn't have to be perfect. And done is better than perfect. Like getting something done is better than sitting on something. And I've done that a fair, you know, like I do that a lot too. I will sit on stuff waiting for it to be perfect. And I think with the podcast and with the book and with the online stuff, somebody else tells me that it has to be done and somebody else puts it out. And that's why I love you doing this podcast. I mean, you're the only one holding yourself accountable to this. Yes. You could easily say, oh, that was terrible, Ellen, and I'll file that away and nobody will ever hear of that again. But you don't. And I think if it was me on my own, I think there'd be a great danger that I would file it in the bottom drawer and say, well, that was a bit, you know, nice idea, but a bit crap. And I'm not saying yours is fantastic, but that's what we do to ourselves. But I think having other people make me accountable and make me produce stuff and me having it being out of my hands has been fantastic in many ways because it means that I have to do it. And then I get the feedback, which tells me that, oh, actually, don't worry.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Like, it's pretty good, actually.
It's good enough. It's more than good enough.
It's good enough.
Yeah. You know, it's probably a whole other conversation in itself about unpacking some of that stuff. Because in my mind, again, if I put my kind of psychologist hat back on there and say, there's probably some personality elements in there, you know, the way you're wired up in the first place, there's probably some environmental impact, you know, of having seen other people around you take chances. But I think a lot of it is that kind of mindset, you know, a bit of self-belief. And yeah, sometimes it's taking the safety net away.
Yeah.
Whether somebody else takes it away for you. And I know I've certainly seen a number of people who have launched their businesses or tried something new because they've been made redundant, for example, and they've thought, right, this is the time. Or in your situation, you know, you've moved to a different location or having a baby where suddenly, you know, life as it was couldn't continue. So you had to change something. So new things crop up and it's about how you deal with those. And again, it probably comes back to that following the curiosity piece as well as with Gilbert's quote, because you just, it's like, well, I need to know where this is going to take me. So I'm just going to pull the rug out from under myself, perhaps. And I know I've done that a bit this year. I've actually said, right, I'm just going to stop doing this particular line of work, even though it's a good income for me and it's within my comfort zone, because the goals are elsewhere. And in some ways that's holding me back. So it is forcing yourself and saying, right, I will take the safety net away and just see where it comes. And hence a podcast.
And good for you. But you know what? There is something about it that has that drive coming from within and that being prepared to take that risk. Because I've got clients too who are, you know, you can't coach somebody into going in and resigning from your job if that is terrifying, you know. And I've got clients who are saying to me, oh God, Cass, you must be banging your head against the wall. Like, we've done all of the work, we've done all of this, we've put all of the scaffolding in place, we've looked, we've done all the pros and cons, but just making that decision to go in and pull away that rug, it's just too terrifying. And people have to come to that point in their own time, you know.
They absolutely do. The books. I should say, do you have a timeline? When will these be available to the general public? Do you know, or is that still in a publisher's hand?
No, the goal is to have these books. Gosh, I have a little panic attack as I say this. to have these books in bookstores before Christmas.
Okay.
This year.
Yep.
So that was the other really nice thing about this offer that was made to me, was that they wanted a quick turnaround, because I would, if there was a long, you know, and I don't know, well, you would know because you've published a book. Oftentimes when the time of getting a publishing contract or somebody committing to your book to actually seeing the book published can be 18 months to 2 years.
Yep, it's a long time.
The podcast is out now. I'm promoting the books on the podcast, and I wanted them out fairly quickly. So they've been really good at saying, yep, well, let's get them out quickly. If you can get them written, Cass,
yes,
we can print it.
Pressure's on you, really, isn't it? You've got to get that bit of work done first.
Hence me clearing the decks and focusing on it, because, you know, there's writing books and getting them finished and, oh, here's my perfectionism again, but I want them to be good, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want them to just be finished. I want to make sure that they're quality. So you've
got to walk that line.
Yeah. So that's my main focus now for the next month. Okay. And they've said to me, look, if they're not done, because I've had issues have gotten in the way and cropped up and, you know, it's been slower than I wanted. But then they've said, look, you know, no drama. These books are timeless, but I would like to see them out by Christmas. Yep.
You've set your own deadline and accountability. See, perhaps you're better at that than you think you are.
Yeah, maybe.
And talking about books, what are your top book recommendations for our listeners? What are the things that have made the biggest difference for you, or that make the biggest difference to your clients?
Oh, I am a massive fan of Brené Brown. First of all, when I see clients, when I first was seeing clients clinically, the number one book I always recommended was The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris, which is the acceptance and commitment therapy kind of layperson's guide.
I just talked to Laura Braid, psychologist in New Zealand, fellow online psychologist group that we're both in. A fabulous conversation all about ACT and
ACT.
Yeah, she recommended Russ's books as well.
Yeah. So as a therapist, you know, I've always been much more an ACT type of therapist more than a CBT, and, you know, with a heavy mindfulness focus. And I just love the concepts in ACT, and that Russ Harris's book is obviously the global bestseller. So because it's so easy to read and people really get a lot out of it straight up, they can relate to it. So I think generally speaking, that's a great book. And then I often find myself referring to Brené Brown's Daring Greatly, about that whole concept of opening yourself up to vulnerability, opening yourself up to risk, which is so relevant to particularly to women who are the perfectionists and high achieving and not living life fully because they're not prepared to dare greatly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I obviously, when I teach mindfulness, people are often asking for recommendations, and Jon Kabat-Zinn is my main man in the mindfulness area. And I'm trained to teach mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is an offshoot of mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is his course. And he's got a couple of really nice little books. One's called Wherever You Go, There You Are. And he's also got one called Mindfulness for Beginners, which has got a little CD in the back. So look, I've got shelves and shelves of books, but I would have to say that those are probably the top ones if I have to give a recommendation.
And we haven't talked about mindfulness, although I know you are a great advocate and a practitioner and teacher of mindfulness. And I'm probably preempting your answer a little bit here. But if you had to give our listeners three top well-being tips, what are the things that you think make the biggest
mindfulness
difference? Mindfulness. What is it about mindfulness for you? You know, what do you think? Because I've had a conversation about mindfulness with a few different people now, because it's not only a hot topic, but I think, you know, there is now a lot of research starting to substantiate its importance to well-being. It's also one of the core pillars of positive psychology.
Yeah, it is.
What is it for you?
It's so multifaceted, but I think that learning to just see thoughts as not facts, we get so caught up in, I mean, well, first of all, mindfulness, of course, being present, like just being aware of what's happening as it is happening. And a lot of people think, well, that sounds like watching paint dry, like now I'm walking to the kitchen, now I'm making a cup of coffee, like, you know, what's the point of that? But it's more about what's going on out there and then what is arising within me in response to that, because we are so full of automatic reactions and judgments and, you know, this is good, that's not good. And if we can become aware of that, that's life-changing for people to notice the stories that we tell ourselves and to be able to, I say to people, thoughts aren't facts, and they go, oh my God, like, oh my God, thoughts aren't facts. I don't have to believe all of that noise in my head. Like, I can just see those as just stories and with no inherent truth. Or, and the fact that you don't have to positive think your way out of those stories, you don't have to suppress those stories, you can just observe them and go, oh, well, that's an interesting, I say to people, just say to yourself, oh, there's that old chestnut again, you know, like those old stories that pop up, and that we don't have to be so bound by them, and we don't have to have all of our behaviors driven and influenced, like we get hijacked all day by these stories, which then create a feeling, which then create a response. And if we can actually watch that happen and have some control over that, I think that is life changing for people.
Absolutely.
And then it just goes, you can go deeper and deeper into, you know, being able to learn. I think the other big thing with mindfulness for me is actually, and happiness, to be honest, like we talk about happiness and I write books about happiness and all of the rest of it. Happiness is being able to tolerate the hard stuff. It's not about removing the hard stuff. Mm-hmm. That's fundamental too. Like mindfulness is not about making all of your stress disappear. It's about saying, I mean, it might reduce it a little bit when you get out of your head, but it's about saying stuff will be hard and that's okay. I can have the capacity to sit with that and not be defeated by that. I don't have to go to my habitual escapes and avoidance patterns. And, you know, like knowing that you have the capacity to tolerate discomfort, I think is also really, really empowering.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And gratitude is my other big one. You know, like I just think, and that's pretty proven in the research as well. Like just being grateful is the fastest way. Thinking of what you have to be grateful for is the fastest way to turn a crappy mood around into a happy one. And no matter how bad things are, there is always something to be grateful for.
Yep.
I fundamentally believe that. And I use that myself all of the time. If I start finding myself going down that path, that spiral of negativity, which is very easy to do, it's just like, okay, stop. Like, let's really keep this in perspective. And let's think about actually what there is to be appreciated in this moment, because there's a fair bit.
Yes. It's interesting, isn't it, that negative, because it's something I talk to people a lot about as well, that negative spiral of, and I think that for me is where that mindfulness comes in, is actually even just having the awareness of that negative spiral of thinking, you know, I've had a bad night's sleep, I've got this stuff I've got to do today, you know, the kids have left a mess all over the kitchen, it's raining, and that kind of spiral of suddenly, you know, now I'm feeling down and my behavior, I'm cranky, and you start to see it play out, and it's having that awareness that, okay, hang on, I can see where this is going, this is not good, this is not going to help me get through a day that is potentially already going to be challenging. So that idea of it, you know, sometimes it's just bad stuff, and the only way I'm going to get through this day successfully is if I stop, pause, reframe it, you know, perhaps yet use a bit of gratitude. What are the good things I've got going on? Even if it's just thinking, you know what, I can do this. And at the end of the day, I'm going to feel so good once it's done.
Exactly.
That you can use like that.
Yeah, exactly. And you can ask yourself in that moment, you're like, what do I need right now? Maybe I just need to go outside for 5 minutes and get some sunshine on me. Maybe I just need to sit down, have a cup of tea and take a few deep breaths. But you've got to be mindful to be able to make that conscious choice about giving yourself what you need to be able to turn it around, you know, as opposed to just getting stuck in that spiral.
Which flows on to a conversation about self-compassion as well then, doesn't it? That you're allowed to actually go and sit outside for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You're allowed to go. That's what you would tell someone else if it was a girlfriend or someone in your family who's having a tough time. Go have a cup of tea. Well, you're allowed to go have a cup of tea as well, giving yourself permission to do that.
Yeah, exactly. So, self-compassion is a major one for me as well. Obviously, it goes hand in hand with mindfulness. There's no point having mindfulness without also having, you know, self-compassion, because otherwise you're just noticing that you're having all of these crappy thoughts and then you're just beating yourself up for them. So, So I'm noticing that I'm having all of these crappy thoughts, but then I'm saying, that's okay. This is hard. Let's just be gentle. Let's just go gently with ourselves, because this is, it's hard and it's a struggle and I feel a bit bad, and that's okay. And give yourself this, the treatment that you would a friend. Exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. And finally, where can people find you? We know that we can find you on the Crappy to Happy podcast, which is in iTunes and all the other places that one finds their favorite podcasts.
It is. My website is cassandradunn.com.au. I have a Facebook page, which is called Happiness Starts Here. I am constantly apologizing in that group for my absence because I'm busy writing books, but they're a patient lot. And when I pop up occasionally with some happiness tips or with some information about what I'm up to or what I'm doing, they're always the first to know inside my Facebook group. So they're probably the, and I'm in Instagram and I've got a Facebook page as well. And all of the links to my socials are on my website. Yeah, I'm easy enough to trace, track down.
And we will look forward to seeing your name in bookstores then around Christmas time this year.
Yes, 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 we will. I will too.
You will too. Cass, thank you so much for everything today, everything that you've shared, for your story and your insight, or the insight into how you got to be where you are today, but also how you engage with the world. You know, I can see, because I have the benefit of being able to see you on the screen. My listeners don't have that benefit, but I can just see the passion and enthusiasm coming through in your eyes, in your mannerisms, but also obviously it's coming through in your voice as well. So a preparedness to take life in both hands and just run with it, but also a bit of the psychology behind how that comes to be. And hopefully that has inspired our listeners today as well.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been heaps of fun.
Good, good. That's what we aim for. Thanks again. And yeah, I will put all the details in the show notes so everyone knows where to find you.
Cool.
What a fun way to round out season one with that interview with Cassandra Dunn. I am buzzing with enthusiasm for grabbing life in two hands, taking new adventures and following my curiosity. And I really hope that Cass has inspired you to do the same. You can find out more about Cass on her website, cassandradunn.com.au. Her podcast, co-hosted with Tiff Hall, is Crappy to Happy, and you'll find it in iTunes, on Android and via your favourite podcast player. We have all of these links, plus Cass's social media links, her book recommendations and her wellbeing tips in the show notes for this episode. Just go to potential.com.au/podcast. And I have some big thank yous to make today. Producing a podcast is a team effort, and I could not have done it without the inspiration of Pat Flynn from Smart Passive Income and the wonderful Power Up podcasting community. I absolutely must acknowledge and thank my producer, Andy Marr, who's not only done a brilliant job with editing and audio production, but he's been very patient with me as I've learned the ropes. Thank you, Andy. Jay, my assistant, does the hard yards behind the scenes, keeping me organised, liaising with guests and putting the show notes and episode pages together on our website. Thank you, Jay. And finally, thank you to you, lovely listener, for being here, sharing your time, inspiring me with your very motivating feedback, and just being part of the Potential Psychology community. I'm thrilled that you're here, and I really look forward to bringing you season two of the Potential Psychology podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.